Welcome everyone to episode 141 of Honestly Unbalanced, and this is an unusual episode. It's a remarkably honest conversation about losing a father to Lewy body dementia, the strange shape of anticipatory grief, and what happened when a deeply personal video by Ryan Ashton is our guest, took him from 300 to 39,000 followers overnight and is now on, I think, almost 150,000. We chat about the pressure to turn vulnerability into a business, protecting people's trust in a world full of grifters, how yoga offered Ryan a presence of mind he hadn't found anywhere else, until, at least, filming it began to turn the practice into performance. Now, I think this is a really moving, funny, and quite refreshing, nicely unpolished conversation about identity, loss, masculinity, and learning to sit beside someone without trying to fix them. As always, a few little perks for you. Get 10% off Lifeform, the best yoga mats in the world, with Hustler 10, H-U-S-L-E-R 10. You can get 10% off everything on the Colourful Standard website. Colourful Standard is for those people that like simple clothing, high quality, good for the environment, but absolutely no branding on it whatsoever. And as the name suggests, they do it in pretty much every colour. And lastly, you can get, I think, one of the biggest discounts on Viva Barefoot shoes. Code Hustler15 will get you 15% off all of their shoes. I'm quite in love with their new sandals. I think they call them the Census sandals. You'll find them easily enough. But yeah, they're pretty awesome. Like Birkenstocks, but with a tiny, tiny, tiny sole. If you're interested also in becoming a yoga teacher, our next training starts in September. There's still time to apply. It runs at Try Yoga Camden in London. It's 4 months long and it consists of a 5-day module, 2 days, 5 days, 2 days, and 5 days. If you've got any questions on that, drop us a line. Anyway, enjoy the episode. Honestly
Unbalanced. So I think actually this conversation is going to be a lot about identity and changing identity.
Yes.
So caring for someone who had dementia significantly changes identity. Grief changes it. Going viral overnight on social media changes suddenly who you are. You're now a viral megastar. Then kind of becoming this yogi changes identity. And then you've got other stuff going on, like, you know, the identity of a climber and alike. So I think that's going to be a big theme today. And I guess for anyone listening, there will be an intro to this podcast, of course. Sure. But this is kind of quite an unusual one because you're not necessarily like a yoga teacher or like. You're equally not like a yoga or wellness expert.
No.
You're someone who's immersing yourself in this world from a place of not knowing.
Yes.
But that is so refreshing to have someone who's coming into this because it's offered them some value to their lives, but has come without any judgment. And admittedly, just for context for everyone, I did contact you to give you like an hour of like consultation randomly on what the yoga world was. I hope that was useful to some degree.
It was eye-opening.
So we have chatted before, but I'd like to talk just immediately about this idea that overnight you became a viral megastar. You got what people would dream of. You went from what 800 followers to 39,000 followers overnight. And I imagine that although people think, oh, I'd love that, that must have come with a massive amount of like pressure and suddenly like, what am I supposed to do with this?
It's bananas. It very much was like 300 followers to like 39,000, and in the weirdest way, because literally, I mean, you hear people say this, and I know it sounds very cringy, but I tried to post this video, had some technical difficulties, did it twice by accident, and it was literally at the point of like, oh, stuff it, like whatever, like I'm gonna go to sleep, and then. And everybody talks about their phone blowing up. Mine doesn't do that because I had it on silent. But you know, this weird situation of like, oh, and you're kind of looking through blurry eyes. Yeah, I shouldn't have my phone next to my bed, but there we go. And you look through blurry eyes and it is ridiculous. And then for the for the preceding like, couple of hours, you try and get up and go about your day. And you're just mush because you're constantly, oh, I wonder what's going on now. And it's a constant pull back to it. I've got a friend who she works in the online space. She works with some creators and things. And she, you know, we've known each other for forever. And she was joking about being, you know, on like front covers of magazines and things like that, which obviously, like, to be clear, hasn't happened, and I'm fine with that. But as the preceding days went on, I started to be contacted by certain notable brands, I suppose you could say. And so something would come through and I'm, you know, such and such has just followed me and messaged me. And along with all of that was a very, very strange, that because of the nature of the video that I'd made, which, just for a brief rundown, is essentially just recounting a period of loss during my life, in a quite a frank way, because of the nature of the video, the experience of being seen was cross-sectioned with a lot of people messaging about some of their really difficult, traumatic times. And I very much felt a mixed sense of, oh my goodness, I'm being seen a lot, with I'm being seen a lot and there's a lot of people that are really hurting, and I felt somewhat sort of duty bound to carry some of that, which obviously isn't particularly healthy to do. So it was a very confusing mixture of situations, because yes, you obviously, you make these things, you do make them to be seen, but you don't, at least I wasn't necessarily making them to go, ah, do you know what? That's gonna go real big. Oh yeah, that'll pull at the heartstrings. You know, that's not where that was coming from. It was very much, it actually came from that I was making some yoga videos and I was getting a few hundred views. And there was a really nice, you know, regular commenters, and you're getting to know a few people. I just said in one of my videos, oh, would you like to get to know the person who isn't very bendy at the moment? Or are you quite happy just being a random bendy, non-bendy person on the internet? And people said, yeah, sure. Like, what's your story? And on that particular day, I was quite in my feelings and was quite frank, and I told that story. So yeah, it's a wild one. And like you said, I thought about it a lot, and you alluded to it in what you said. I think in some ways, certainly for some people, I think this experience is seen as equal to like winning the lottery. It's like, oh, you've got this, you've done it. There you go. And it's a lot more complex than that. I mean, at least for somebody that probably possibly thinks a bit too much. Mm. So yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster.
So on that thinking note, kind of what was the motivation behind that video? And I know you said for people to get to know you slightly, but you revealed a lot of yourself.
Yes.
Was it almost just cathartic, just a nice way to talk about it and be heard, be seen? Was it because you had a desire to kind of help people, let them feel they're not alone? And then if so, had you prepared for the fact that lots of people might listen to it and then actually want your help? What was the motivations?
So I'd got to a point, after a lot of the losses, I'd saved up, I'd gone traveling, and I got to the point, I'd come back, and I was at a really, really high point of self-acceptance. I was very much sat with where I was, both kind of physically with what my body was doing, but mostly kind of, I suppose you could say spiritually, mentally. I was just very sat with like, well, do you know what? I'm living at home with my mum, and a lot of people might feel shame about that, but I just am where I am. My life has taken me on this path. And each time along that path, I have found that the more I'm able to accept where I am, the better. Cool. Mm. To the same effect, during that year of travel, every time that I had been able to speak really frankly about my life experiences, I had, with 100% success rate, found that it either greatly benefited my life or somebody else's life I was talking to. So there was a bit of that in there, in that, like, yeah, do you know what? These overtly not very nice things have happened in my life. They have led me to where I'm at. Not only that, but there is also a side where I know literally every other person has a pretty equivalent story to this. And we function best when we are just, you know, we're not putting up all those barricades and all those kind of, you know, pretend images of ourselves. I really think we operate best when it's just like, yeah, that these horrendous things have happened, and I connect better with people, and I was able to do that. So a bit of a long answer, but essentially a combination of just being really accepting as to where I was at that stage, with knowing that we connect best with each other when you take down the barricades of going, oh, I work in my corporate job, or this is my car, etc. And work best when you just go, yeah, this is who I am. Like, take it or leave it. So it definitely wasn't on the side. I suppose I thought it may help others in the idea of seeing somebody else who's been through the difficulty and can still maybe crack a smile every now and then. At most, I was no way expecting it for them people to be reaching out to me directly to go, oh, can you can you life coach me, or can you help me to do this, or how do you do X, Y, and Z? That wasn't the side I was prepared for in any way.
So on this talk of identity, then, you said brands reached out to you. So suddenly you got pressure to maybe partner with them, share the content with their particular agenda. You've got people who are now looking to you for support or inspiration or guidance or life coaching explicitly.
Yeah.
And they're asking for your services that don't exist.
Yeah.
So, like, did you suddenly feel that, okay, well, there is pressure to be someone else? There is pressure to be Ryan Reps, not Ryan?
Yes.
And how did you deal with that, if you have done yet?
So,
am I speaking to Ryan now or Ryan Reps?
No. You're speaking to whoever you'd like. Hopefully it's just Ryan. The pressure that I felt, the immediate pressure that I felt in the video I mentioned, and the word, I look back at the wording and I can see why it's gone down a certain road. I mention about a goal that both myself and my brother, away from social media, have had now, which is that we both want to take our mum on a dream holiday. There's so much she's been through. She is an incredible woman. And to be able to turn around and do that. But the wording I used specifically was raise. I want to raise some money, which clearly has connotations with a charity type of aspect, et cetera, which in no way was the point. So I felt this pressure that in many ways I had experienced the very best of social media. People had seen my story. They really want to get behind me. They see something in me that maybe they identify with, and they want to support me. I mean, how often do you see that on the internet, that nearly unanimous support? That's golden. So I felt this pressure behind that golden moment that I have to, air quotes, kind of capitalize on it and make the dream holiday happen now. And I just wasn't prepared in terms of kind of a business sense on that side of things for how to make that happen in a way that I was happy. It initially kind of happened with lots of people almost, nearly angrily saying, start a GoFundMe. And I eventually go, I'm not comfortable with that. So then you sit back and you go, well, hang on, you've had the best of the internet unanimously come together to try and achieve this thing. And you've gone, well, hang on, yes, thank you, but not quite in that way. So how are you going to do it? And there was a real period where I felt a lot of pressure about that, more so on the pressure of making this dream happen right now, because the internet has a short memory, or at least that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. I felt more pressure of that than possibly turning up on social media and on camera. But that kind of all waves through. So, yeah, there was that pressure to make this happen instantly. And then also the side where I'm still navigating. I would like to do good in the world. I'm not a yoga teacher. I'm not a life coach, just in case any of the listeners were worried about that. I've not suddenly turned up with an audience and decided I could be a life coach. That's much more complex. So I don't have a traditional thing to go, well, here's the offering. So yeah, there was a definite period there. And eventually I just got to the point, like, hang on, although some people might like to see me succeed, on any of the things I'm putting out, people are still wanting me to succeed. It's not necessarily just this holiday aspect. I took the pressure off myself. I realized there is no time basis on this. and I can take a breath. Yes, you see these quote unquote overnight successes, and they do all the things incredibly well. For whatever reason, I'm not in that mode. I'm gonna try to navigate this in a way that feels better for me, rather than navigate it in a way that is expected of me, if that makes sense.
And I think it comes down to intention as well. And I think that maybe that's why people are drawn to you. Like, in a world full of grifters, you are not a grifter. And I struggle with that to some degree. Like, I see people who, the way they're packaging things or phrasing things, you can kind of see the motive.
Yes.
Even down to, you know, how they're using AI or their branding, you can see that everything's just not quite the truth. Or everything is just a little bit of elaboration.
But I think indeed, you sense that, don't you?
You can, but yet, you know, they're clearly succeeding. So whether it is that other people don't sense it or other people just don't care because it's offering them some value and it's fine. There is a wonderful, I don't know his name, but there's a wonderful Instagram account that he just berates grifters. And he'll pick, like, every few days he'll pick a grifter and just talk about their story and how ultimately they're hypocrites and are like, oh, I love it. And it's all done in a very sarcastic way. Maybe he'll expose me at some point. Maybe I'm a grifter. But I think that's why people are drawn to you, because everything seems very, very real. Not seems, is very real, is very honest, is very open. So going forward, like, if someone said to you, okay, I'm going to give you 500,000 followers, but the condition is you have to become a little bit more of a curated version of yourself with a little bit more intention, and you're going to have a social media manager and a sponsorship, would you be comfortable with that? Would you go for it?
So I would possibly take the manager side of it, and I would possibly take some of that. I wouldn't take the followers per se. What I'm trying to rest towards is a way like you mentioned about grifters. My idea of a nightmare is somebody going, Ryan, that guy, he's a grifter. What I'm trying to possibly navigate towards is, and what I've said on some videos is that if I am using a brand or I have a partnership, it is either something I genuinely use or something I genuinely believe will help the people that follow me. There has been some, I won't sort of necessarily name names, there's been some contact from certain brands. I mean, I've had some quite funny contact, which I could possibly tell you about in a second, but there have been some brands who have contacted me. I don't use the product, and I really sit on as to whether will this be a net benefit. I feel I have people's trust, and an abuse of that trust, you only get one shot at that. You abuse that trust once and it's gone. So yeah, I wouldn't take the followers. I might take management in the sense that, I mean, I don't know this, I'm too new to this, but I perhaps naively believe that there would be some management styles there that would work on my basis, in that I could collaborate on the quote unquote business side of this whole social media malarkey, but only go towards things that I sit with appropriately. It's a real, you have been in the online space for a very, very long time. You people know what they are getting from you. It's high expertise and a credible amount of experience. So when you have an offering, there is so much inherent value behind it, where it's like, oh yeah, cool, that's Adam, we know what they're getting from them. I'm so new, I don't have that bank of, for example, 20 odd years plus yoga experience. So if I suddenly said, hi guys, I'm a yoga teacher, buy my course, it's gonna look janky. So, it's something I, you know, what can I offer? And there's a weird side of this where I want my social media to be a direct reflection of what I'm experiencing. But at the same time, and I feel uncomfortable mentioning this, at the same time, it takes a lot more work. And when there is no monetary benefit there, there then becomes just a real world, well, okay, I only have a certain amount of time. You're putting effort in. You're not currently getting monetary reward, which is not what you're doing it for. But without that monetary reward, there's going to become a point where I don't have the time in the day to do the nice things, if that makes sense. Yeah. So yeah, there's a whole, like in terms of identity, it really, I think if you're not conscious of that, I think it could really, really twist you, perhaps towards being a grifter. I don't know.
What was your motivation initially about starting the account?
So, like I mentioned, I'd gone on these wonderful travels. I was in a very, very unique position in that I had a really wonderful boss at my job, and I had a sabbatical approved. I came back, had a phone call with him, and he was talking through the projects that were coming up. And on that phone call, I just kind of got to the point, I was like, I'm really sorry. I don't think I can come back into that world for a number of reasons. It was, in terms of the corporate world, in many situations, it was the best possible situation because my boss was very good. But even then, there was many reasons why I just couldn't. And at the end of travels and with that in mind, I was going to become an online virtual assistant. I was going to start a page and just document me building an online business to doing things like email handling and all the things that virtual assistants do. However, during that, possibly some previous mental difficulties that I hadn't quite all buttoned up since before the traveling, they settled back in. And I started that feeling, which anybody who's felt particularly low, that I always describe it as my brain moving through treacle. You can think through all of the angles possible, but at the actual doing part, at least from my experience, that's where you really become through treacle. And when starting an online business, as some of your listeners can identify with, if they're yoga teachers, you have to do so much. There is so much upfronted effort and upfronted movement that you need to generate. And I just wasn't generating it. In a word, I was being lazy. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to believe is behind that laziness is actually some more pain and reasons than just a word would equate to. So I started the page to be like, I'm going to start this business. And I very quickly wasn't doing the things necessary. So I thought, okay, the other thing I wanted to do on social media was yoga. I'll do that whilst I figure the other thing out. And then obviously what happened.
Why did you want to do yoga?
Ah, okay. So this... It partly explains as to where I got into yoga from, if that's okay.
Yeah.
When I was 3 years old, I won't go the whole thing, but I affectionately grew up in somewhere I call the arse end of nowhere. I'm in the countryside, and growing up, yoga wasn't a thing that blokes did. Now, during some of the difficulties of my life and loss and things like that, I'd become exposed to some elements of meditation. And through that, just some what I would describe some light Buddhist philosophy, very, very light touch. So that was in my mind when I went traveling. Then I had some incredible experiences, and I actually did my very first yoga session in Sri Lanka. And you know, your listeners may understandably hate me when I describe this very idyllic yoga shala in the mountains of Sri Lanka, but that was my first experience. So with that being my first experience, I fell in love with it. It was incredible. I experienced a type of presence of mind that I hadn't experienced before. So having experienced that, I did some more sessions whilst traveling, and I came home and I was like, this has to be part of my life going forwards. I can't lose that. And I thought, you know, that crossed over with online. I was starting to get fed some yoga content, and all of it was either educational, which is brilliant, or this is an incredibly ridiculous position. Look at me. And I thought, well, I'm none of that. I'd like to try, you know, I enjoy editing videos. I'd like to give it a go. Why don't I do a daily thing where I go, look, I'm not bendy. Maybe I'll become bendy. Very, very, you know, reduced image of yoga as a whole, but I thought, yeah, I'd give it a go. So that's where it kind of started.
And is all of this kind of emergence of yoga in your life, was that before, after, or during, like, the loss of your father and the dementia?
A little while after, yeah. So the whole sort of dementia journey is a number of years, but my father died. There was kind of a year and a half, I'm just a bit hazy now, but a year and a half, 2 year period where about a year and a half, where dad had physically died, and I knew that I wanted to go and do the travels. So yeah, it was a couple of years. The yoga really happened a couple of years after dad passed.
Now we'll jump back to the yoga, but I think this kind of conversation is you sort of have at this point, this identity with, you know, looking after the father, grief, and a light that goes yes. along with that.
Yes.
Just if we can talk quickly about dementia. So it's Lewy body dementia, and I'd heard of dementia. I hadn't heard of those two words before it.
Yeah.
Like what is that? Like, is it then like a terminal thing? Because in my knowledge of dementia, that was something you have, and death would likely be a result of something else. But dementia was just there. Yeah, that was my understanding of it. I think one of my grandparents had dementia.
Yeah, yeah. So I was the same. I'd never heard of Lewy body. My nan on my mum's side, excuse me, my nan on my mum's side had Alzheimer's, so I knew what that was. So Lewy body dementia, very similar to Alzheimer's and other dementias. What I always describe is that with all dementias, cognitive ability over time will decrease. That there is no currently, you know, you don't take a magic pill and it gets better again. Lewy body is exactly the same. The difference with Lewy body is, in our experience, it was a high amount of changeability. So we would always talk about dad with having plateaus. There are certain periods where he would not stabilize, but his ability, you know, his decline would plateau for a bit. In a plateau, in as extreme as 15 minutes to 15 minutes, from 15 minutes, dad would be talking to you as I am with full sentences. He would generally know who he was, for example. He may be able to feed himself, toilet, et cetera, et cetera. 15 minutes later, he's become irate because he's asking you to pass the flip-flop. What on earth is the flip-flop? The flip-flop is actually the TV controller, but the connection between his brain and his mouth has disappeared. So he can no longer communicate. He doesn't know who you are during these 15 minutes. He may well be experiencing things like hallucinations. And then 15 minutes back again, he's back fully. So Lewy body dementia, in our experience, the real challenge, for lack of a better word, is how changeable they become in a very, very quick period. So I think with all dementias, you don't necessarily know who you're going to encounter moment to moment. That I would suggest that is exacerbated with Lewy body dementia.
And Lewy body, is that the name of someone that had it? What is Lewy body?
What's truthfully, I don't know. I know it is in relation to the way that proteins are attached to neurons in the brain. It's something that when dad was diagnosed, my brother, who's very kind of opposite to me, researched it, wanted to know everything about it. Mm. And as a slight protective mechanism, I knew that this was going in a not very nice place. And I prefer to not, although I have a scientific background, I prefer to not know the science of it as like I'm going to deal with what's in front of me rather than what's in the textbook. So yeah, I don't know.
Because you can't change what's in the textbook. I think that's important. I think some people, as you say, your brother perhaps, use that as a coping mechanism.
Yes.
But again, that information is almost irrelevant, isn't it?
So sometimes yeah.
What's important is what's actually in front of you, tangibly.
Yeah, yeah. Very much what's in front of you. And just the intensity of what arises through that. So yes, it's not a particularly good day out.
No.
And but yeah.
Is it terminal or is it linked
so
to
the cause? I don't know if it would technically be classed as terminal. But everybody with dementia will either pass of the dementia itself or dementia related things. For example, I'll mention my own father's experience. On my dad's death certificate he has died of the effects of Lewy body dementia.
Ah.
Physiologically, my father semi-starved. He was in a care home. He would cruise. His cruising weight as a healthy person would be about approximately 80 kilograms. When he passed, he weighed a shade under 40 kilograms. So the doctor has listed that it's the effects of Lewy body dementia, but along there was some bleeds on the brain because of falling, difficulty getting foods in and things like that. So whilst I don't technically know if the dementia itself is classed as terminal, everybody with dementia will either die of the dementia itself or the effects of dementia.
I didn't know that at all. And it must be, like, when my dad was diagnosed with cancer, I spoke a lot about, I can't remember if I spoke about it during or afterwards, like this preemptive grief. Like when you
Yes.
know someone is passing away, I guess it can go two ways. Like you can have this preemptive grief of someone you're losing, which of course exacerbated when you are losing them mentally as well, and it kind of comes and goes, compared to
Yeah.
someone just getting physically ill. But there is this preemptive grief, which can, I guess, for some people mean they can't deal with what's in front of them. But for some people, they actually maybe protect themselves too much. They shut down to it. They know what's happening and can see the grief emerging, so become quite numb. And I think that's
Yes.
what I did.
Right.
And when my dad was passing away from cancer very slowly, there were many things that I wish I did that I didn't. I was like, oh, no, I can't get my classes covered. I was going to do it. Well, it's like, in hindsight, I just like, why didn't someone just say to me, just go home? Go on
Yeah.
holiday for a week or two, do some things with your father. And I didn't really get that. I was just like not getting classes covered, getting on with kind of life. And my dad wasn't really talking about it either when I did go home. And even when he was actually on his deathbed, pretty much, I was supposed to teach in Spain and I went
To Spain.
for like a night. And it was an encouragement from extended family, like that's what he would have wanted.
Right.
And I, to be honest, in hindsight, wish I hadn't have gone.
Yes.
Those
Yeah.
20 people in the workshop would have been fine as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you can talk a little bit about that, like this preemptive grief, and then or did you have that? Or have you had a lot, has it now emerged afterwards a lot more?
So, yes, it's I know it sounds silly, but just briefly, thank you for sharing your bits about that, about your experience. I personally appreciate that.
Okay.
Sorry for the experiences, and I also appreciate you mentioning about that final class and about the hindsight of those 20 people would be fine. I definitely did at certain points did similar things with my work. I to answer your question directly, I definitely did have preemptive grief. What was very interesting. It was the way that presented for somebody like myself compared to somebody like my mum. One thing I often talk about with Lewy body dementia in particular is trying to get to certain checkpoints. So to help myself with this preemptive grief, say we're waiting for a set of test results, I would purposely name that as a checkpoint to the family. That's our next checkpoint. We are not going to think past that. A phrase that I used a lot. Is that we're not going to answer the universe's questions for it. I'm not going to tell myself the stories as to what that test result says until we actually have the result. So I don't care after that test result at the moment. So that was something that helped with that preemptive grief. But actually experiencing it, this isn't great for a podcast, but I struggle to put it into words. Because of the nature of Lewy body dementia, where you get them back, for example, there would be multiple times where we were lucky that a certain stage dad was in a care home. I would go to the care home because I would dread going to the care home to sit next to my father, who is a shell of who he was. I would dread it. But I also, in equal parts, I couldn't not go. I had to go. Not because anybody else told me to, but there was an inherent I had to go. There were some times where I'd go there, I'd sit there. Maybe he would be mildly violent towards me. Maybe he would be really lovely. Maybe we would have a chance at sharing something together. Maybe the entire time is just there is no words because dad's communication is gone and maybe he's sleeping. And the difficulty is, I'd have a session like that where there'd be not any connection anyway. Dad doesn't know where he is and he's in a hallucination. So he's gone to the world. And I'd stand up and I'd say, right, I've got to go now, Dad. I don't, In my mind, I'm assuming he can hear me, even if he can't. But right, bye, Dad. I love you lots. I'll see you later. And out of nowhere, he would then say, no, night, Ryan, don't let the bed bugs bite, which is what he used to say to me as a child, putting me to bed. But I'd have been there for an hour and a half and not had anything out of him. So that preemptive grief, you go on a constant sine wave where you reach certain points of acceptance to a degree. It's like, okay, well, this is where this is going. And then all of a sudden you hear your dad's voice say that back to you out of the shell of who he is physically, and you're pulled right back to my dad's still in there. And you want to hold on to that, my dad's still in there, desperately. So that makes that preemptive grief difficult in a way I have yet to find words or a poem that puts it appropriately. It just makes it incredibly challenging. To the point in which when dad physically died, we spoke about multiple times about dad's multiple deaths along this journey, but when dad physically died, we very nearly didn't have a funeral because our thinking at the time was, well, we've seen him die like, you know, 50 odd times by now, die in inverted commas, in have multiple deaths. So why would we need a funeral? Whereas actually we did have a funeral. And I'm very glad that we did. So yes, sorry, possibly a slightly long answer, but that preemptive grief, and I feel conflicted talking about it because I never want to feel comparing to somebody else's grief. Nobody wins that game, but that preemptive grief, it was a constant sine wave.
And then afterwards, the grief afterwards, how did you cope with that? Was there an extension of it? How did you deal with that?
So obviously I'm not going to have grief. I've had the multiple deaths. I'm going to be fine. No, you're bloody not. I had high expectations. I remember I was lucky to access therapy, which was incredibly valuable to me. And I remember talking to a therapist who I'd been speaking to over a number of years. And I think it must have only been a couple of months, maybe a month and a half after dad's physical death. And I was having a number of difficulties in other parts of my life that were obviously related. But I just had huge frustration, massive frustration, because this had been my life for years. And I'd handled this over and over again, sometimes brilliantly and sometimes not so brilliantly. And I got to this stage and I got so frustrated at always being the person that's struggling. Because dementia is so drawn out, I just got to this point where, particularly with identity, it wasn't an identity I in any way wanted to inhabit. And I felt all sorts of shame and frustration that my identity had gone from being perhaps the son that's doing all the right things and sorting out all the stuff to now just, it's poor Ryan, he's struggling again. So after dad's death, I had this mixture of frustration because clearly the actual death was still going to have a knock-on effect. But I had this expectation that I'm almost an old tooth at this. I've dealt with all this loss over and over and over again. I should be, quote unquote, a professional. Why am I struggling? So I think after the actual death, I think I, purposely or not, I think I tried to kind of semi-ignore it and just get on with life. Because you kind of want an element of that.
That's so interesting. it's an idea from Stoicism, with a capital T, that you should actively rehearse loss in many senses. And if you rehearse loss, that has multiple benefits. One is you appreciate things in the moment more,
yes,
because you've imagined losing them. And the other benefit is when or if that thing actually happens, you have prepared and rehearsed for it. And I think that might be all well and good to some degree, if you lose your phone.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm sure, some of the Stoics, like Seneca, are like, yes, they did it in very hard circumstances and managed it. But unless you are well versed and well practiced, you're not prepared. We are not prepared for any of this stuff.
No. I really like the concept that Stoicism that provides in that sense. Is like you should it almost sounds like you're describing like a dry run of loss. You should practice loss. I love the concept of the preparation, but I completely agree. I wouldn't have in any way been possible to prepare myself for what we went through.
So what did help you? I'm sure we'll get to the fact that yoga helped you and climbing helped you. But was there anything that anyone did for you at that point in time that helped you? Was there anything someone said, something you read, poetry? You mentioned poetry before. Did anything help you through that time afterwards?
I went through a period, which I would like to say I am not currently in anymore, but I went through a period of immersing myself in some armchair philosophy a lot. Whether it's appropriate, you know, historically backed philosophy or armchair philosophy, it was all things that were starting to help me. It was also principally through therapy. Unfortunately, I started that dementia journey with some wonderful support structures. And one of those key support structures dissolved very suddenly. So I went into quite a dark place. And through that dark place, through things like therapy, one of the things, which isn't necessarily the principal thing that helped me, but one of the things that did help to a degree was art. I always thought art, I never really saw the point in it. I hated it at school. And I got to a point where that support structure had gone, dad was in a particularly bad spot. And my therapist asked me how I was doing. And mentally at that point, I didn't know in which emotions were coming from the loss, the recurrent loss of dad or the loss of that relationship. I didn't know where I was. The only word I used was fractured. And he said to me, he's like, okay. He said, well, you're feeling fractured and you told me you can't put into words what you're feeling. That's what art is for. I was like, what do you mean? He was all art. That is the pure expression of art, whether it's poetry, artwork in its painted form, music. It expresses human pain, love, loss, whatever it might be, in a way that words in isolation cannot get to. And that day I drove home in my little Ford Focus, and I put on some 2000s new metal that I grew up with, and I just screamed my little heart out, and it felt so much better. It was done in a healthy way. So one of those things I would say would be art, and realizing that we don't always, yes, intellectualizing your emotions and your pain in words is great, but there is also a time for expressing them in a non-verbal way. And whether that's screaming your little heart out to Slipknot that you grew up with or whatever it is, that expression is needed. You can talk all day sometimes, but having that, and that really did help at one point.
I have to ask, did you do any of the artwork behind you as well? Is that your
artwork? No, I didn't. No. I keep my little scribbles to myself and they won't see the light of day.
you never know. That might be your grift, selling your artwork. selling your grief artwork.
Yeah.
thank you for sharing that. Do you think, I'd love to do a little bit of quickfire now, related a little bit to that, and a little bit to yoga as well, because sure. It's important to have the yoga conversation. Do you think going through that has made you in any sense a better person?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. I could have a long answer to that, but the short answer would be absolutely yes. There is a strange, I became aware of a strange thing, which isn't necessarily universally applicable to everybody, but it applies to me, where people talk about horrendous life traumas in the way that if they had a magic button, would they go back and erase them? And I wouldn't erase mine, as horrendous as it was. It has made me see life in a completely different sense, which is has a beauty and value to that in itself from such a horrible situation that I don't want to let go of that. So yeah, I would absolutely.
So you started yoga. How would you identify, if you're doing like a little elevator pitch to me, how would you identify the main things that yoga has given to you? Why should I do yoga?
Oh, and it's for my practice in its purest form, it has given me a presence of mind that I haven't achieved through any other means. Therapy, isolated meditation, sport, which is a great love of mine. The presence of mind is incredible.
Is there any kind of cliches that have annoyed you, or things that you just haven't understood at all about the yoga world?
Yes, sometimes. I'm sure there's reasons for it, but sometimes my experience as a newer yoga person is the language that sometimes it feels as though people are hiding behind. There is obviously terminology in any sport, activity, hobby, etc. And the language in yoga has rooted history, so I understand that. But as a new person, sometimes people are talking in a semi-different language, and I just want to hold my hand up and go, I don't have a clue what you're talking about. Could you translate what you're talking about for somebody like me, please? So it's a very beginner related frustration, but something I think sometimes isn't necessarily considered.
I think the argument there sometimes is, well, you know, we should honor culture, we should honor the language of Sanskrit, and I'm all for honoring the path of yoga. However, I'm all for the fact that yoga has immense value for people's lives, as it has for you. And I want to, as a teacher, make it as accessible as possible. And if that means I'm using English words, I don't think that's a big deal. If I can make it accessible to the people, maybe along the journey, there is some education of Sanskrit words, but I'm not only speaking in Sanskrit because I am a yogi.
I would say in my beginner experience, at least, the best teachers do exactly what you've said, because I'm somebody who wants to learn all of that. But in my first instance, I can't be expected to step straight into it. Mm. So to do the duality of having the English, but also then taking me onto that journey as to what these mean, those are the absolute best teachers for a beginner like me, because we want to go there with you. We just need to step in.
Are there any other things that you think teachers could do to be more supportive of beginners?
Of what, sorry?
Beginners. Oh.
I think you talk about it a lot, not to blow smoke up your bum, but you talk about it a lot. I think the way you talk about the expectation to step towards a position, not achievement of the position, has value beyond probably a lot of yogis' realization. Mm. I was speaking to somebody, a man actually, just last week, and he was talking about going to a men's only yoga. And part of the reason he was going to men's only yoga is because he felt overwhelmed seeing all these very, in his words, incredibly flexible women. And he felt overwhelmed that, well, I can't do that. So if the wording of those cues is, and now we're going to do this, compared to we're going to move towards, we're going to try to achieve, that as a beginner has so much value. It's a friendly pat on my back to go, okay, well, your downward dog might not be brilliant, but it doesn't, nobody cares. So we're going to move towards that, has massive value.
I try and call it direction of travel. I mean, the direction of travel is here. And then as a teaching point, I use a lot of like sarcasm. And I'm like, you know, if you can get your chest on the floor, to be honest, I'd be concerned about you. That suggests lots of passive range of motion. Or, you know, the people that can grab their head behind their foot aren't necessarily happier people. There's no correlation. Yeah. Or just the idea, you know, one day, guys, you'd be able to do this and you can put it on your CV. Or show your friends at a New Year's Eve party and no one will care. At best, they'll be indifferent. Like, I try and tie in these constant, slightly sarcastic dad jokes, not because I want to be humorous, but it's my way of actually leveling the playing field. Yeah. And letting go of like comparison and alike. Where are you at with your yoga path? Like, have you managed to, and we had this conversation a little bit earlier, separate, and this is key, your yoga practice from your yoga performance as Ryan Rex?
I got to a point with, because my inherent love of yoga started with the presence that it gives you. Obviously, the act of filming that, as much you can build all of the kind of walls in your mind that you think you can, you have a camera pointed at you. That sets in a deep level, whether you like it or not. So I got to a point where that performative side took any presence of mind away. And yoga started to become a thing that I no longer loved, which is very sad. So I stepped back from yoga. I also took the pressure off of myself for doing this daily. There was too much tied up together for that. I do the, you know, the gentle, I'm going to do 5 minutes, which turns into the 20, which turns into the half an hour. And excuse me. I do that purposely, sporadically. I'm slowly building up my love with the mat again. Each time I was rolling out the mat, it was it was not a lovely experience. So I'm building up the relationship again, away from cameras.
I think it's so important.
Yeah, my aim being to have that relationship back again. I have my own practice away from cameras. And then I film the odd thing. But if I have a filming day, which is a piece of advice that you have given me, is to have both the filmed element, but also a completely separate practice myself. So yeah, that's what I'm moving back towards. I'm happy in the sporadic point at the moment, and I want to move it back towards a place of a bit more presence.
Nice. I often say no one's ever seen me practice yoga. Unless you're in a class with me and I'm practicing in a class, no one online has ever seen me practice yoga.
Interesting.
Ever. Like, I've never filmed, as far as I'm aware, I don't think they ever did a full yoga session. I've never set up the camera, like, while I'm doing a practice or while I'm doing a meditation, because it would just ruin, even a meditation, a 20-minute meditation. If I put a camera there, the first thing I think about after that meditation is going to turn the camera off.
Yes.
I don't want that. So 100%, I don't think anyone, if they want the value from the yoga or meditation practice, do not film it ever. Yes. Like, if you don't care about the yoga and the benefits of it, if you're really doing like a calisthenics class or a stretchy class, and everything, the yoga philosophy, do what you want, I guess it's fine. I think there's a studio in Bali, and it seems like everyone literally has a tripod in front of their mat.
Yeah.
And my view is you can still have a yoga inspired movement practice, but you simply, I don't believe, can get a decent yoga actual practice if there's a camera in front of you, because you're always going to be thinking about performance and what's going on.
And I think the wording you used, the yoga inspired movement practice, you've mentioned this, Abby, before. I think that is key as to what I would like to achieve when I film bits of yoga again, is those are going to be yoga inspired movement practices, because there is no spiritual side for me on that. Then I'm moving my body, I'm putting it on camera, maybe I'm being a bit silly, ideal. I 100% agree.
Or just treat it as pure content creation. It's not even a yoga inspired movement practice. It's yoga. It's yoga content creation.
Yeah.
That's it. It's nothing to do with yoga. It's not even a practice, to be honest, is it?
I find it incredible that with your breadth of experience, you can say you've never filmed one of your practices. And I think that in itself speaks volumes.
Yeah, I think the most I've ever done is that when I was first learning to headstand, I think the first video camera phone had come out.
Yeah.
And I filmed myself. It wasn't a practice. I just filmed myself trying to do a headstand. I wanted to understand why I couldn't do it. And then when I filmed myself, it was so obvious, like physics emerged. I'm like, yeah, well, your bum's over there. Bum that way. But no, I've not got any desire to ever do it. And if I do like pretend to meditate, it's never really meditation. It might just be a picture of me like in a lotus pose somewhere dramatic. It's not a meditation.
Yeah,
I think that's key. We're both men. Tell me, as a maybe like a final question, is what you think men could do to be better supportive of each other when they go through stuff like grief, or as well when they're exploring something slightly new and alternative like yoga? How can we be better for each other?
Interestingly, the first words that came up in my head were get your head out your ass. There's all these preconceived ideas of things, and things like experiences like grief show you that those preconceived ideas are complete tosh. So if you're supporting a mate, get yourself get your head out of your own ass a little bit and consider truly where they're at, instead of those preconceived ideas of where they should be at. One thing through my experience that my closest friends did, I'm still blown away by, was just how they were able to fully accept me as I was showing up. They had no other expectations of what I should or shouldn't be doing. They just dealt with me as I presented.
Nice.
Whether that's a little bit of a quiet, mumbly, like whatever's going on that day, or whether I'm actually quite chirpy that day, their ability to their ability to hold me in both of those instances, because on the slightly quiet and mumbly days, in ways I wouldn't expect, they put an arm around me and they sit in the trenches with me. They didn't solve the problem, they just sat with me. That's really what I mean about getting your head out of your ass, and not expecting somebody to be somewhere different. You sit with them precisely where they're at in that moment. And if that means just sitting in the trenches and going, yeah, this is rubbish, this sucks. I'm not going to give you an answer to out of it. There's so much value in that. Equally as much, there's value in, on that particular day, I'm quite chirpy. Cool. We're not actually going to bring you back down with how ill somebody was. You're presenting quite chirpy. You seem quite well. We're going to have a bit of a laugh.
Nice.
So I hope that translates as to what I mean about getting your head out of your ass. It's really not having expectations, and sometimes that ability to sit with somebody in the trenches in the moment is valuable beyond measure.
Love it. I think that's a lovely way to leave it. But can you tell people where to find you and about your the courses that you're running and delivering?
So I am Ryan Ashton Was Here. Sorry, I've got an awful cough. I'll try that again. I am at Ryan Ashton Was Here on Instagram and now on TikTok. I am selling no courses.
Well, thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for being so open. It's been a pleasure to chat again.
Thank you, Adam. It's been a proper pleasure. Honestly, thanks for having me. Unbalanced.